Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagolani-Albov. Today, we are really excited to be talking about a geographical area that we've definitely touched on in other conversations in the podcast, but we have not had the chance to focus on, which is really, really exciting. This particular geographic area happens to be one of my absolute favorite latitudes in the world. Has anybody guessed where we're going today? I don't know about you, Christopher. I don't even want to waste a minute not talking to our guest because I am so excited for the conversation we are going to have. So the mic is yours. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us what our mystery latitude is?
Thank you very much for this invitation. My name is Ksenia Hanacek. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology, Autonomous University of Barcelona, and I'm a researcher, and I am doing a research stay at University of Helsinki, Global Development Studies, and I have been focusing my research on the Arctic region, and I look into the region as a commodity extraction frontiers, and I also look at environmental conflicts that arise as a consequence of these huge amounts of extractive, tendencies in the region.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ksenia, and welcome on. So I guess to start out, you're coming from being in Spain. You're originally from Croatia, correct? How did you get to be studying the Arctic? Such a different sort of environment.
Indeed. Thank you very much for this question. Yeah, originally I'm from Croatia. And also my background and my first master's degrees is in engineering, actually, strongly focused on, agricultural engineering, the soils, physics, soil chemistry, microbiology, as well as plant physiology. But there was this turn, at my last year of the first master's degree, when I had this class on global ecology and social issues related to ecology, and environmental science. And this is when I saw, or I felt in that moment, that this is what I want to focus on in my future research. And I moved to Barcelona and I saw this master program in political ecology and ecological economics at ICTA. And I started to think of doing the PhD directly, but then I thought this is too much of social sciences, no? And then I decided to do the master's degree first in political ecology and environmental justice. And after my PhD degree, I started to work for the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice. And my first focus on geographical region, was the Russian Federation. As we start to collect the data and doing the research on extractive industries in the country, the data actually led us to the Arctic region. And then as the research developed and we started to see more similar cases, in the region, also in the European part, also in the United States, Alaska, and Canada. And as the research developed later on and in discussions with my co-authors, we decided to focus on the Arctic region as one single regional unit of analysis to get to know the whole picture of what's going on in the region. And this is how I started doing the research on the Arctic region. At the same time, when this was happening, Professor Dr. Markus Kruger was doing a research stay at our institute. And then we started to develop all this conversation and also collaboration on the research and extractive industries in the region. So this is why here I am and I'm focusing on the Arctic region.
That's quite a jump from engineering into the social sciences. I can hardly even imagine the process that you must have gone through for that. Now, you mentioned something. You talked about you started working after your doctorate at the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that, what do we call it? Is it an entity, an organization, a data space?
Thank you. The Global Atlas of Environmental Justice is the global database on extractive industries and environmental conflicts taking place all around the world on the global level. It's a part of an ERC advanced grant project called Environmental Justice, awarded to Professor Dr. John Martinez Alier in 2016. And it's an academic activist database produced between academic and activist actors, in which we document all these extractive industries all around the world, and also social movements for environmental justice, in which people call for environmental, social, and economic sustainability. And we call it also, my colleague in his work, Arnim Scheidel, call it forces of sustainability. This is what we are documenting. And I would like to add also, although these spaces might be perceived as spaces of oppression, not towards the people that protect their lands, it is important to see it also as spaces of resistance. And this is what we are focused on in the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. I've taken a look at it myself. It's a really interesting and enlightening resource, and we can definitely put a link to it in the show notes for all of our listeners to be able to check out. So getting into the Arctic, can you maybe sort of set the stage for us? I know that this is, of course, going across many countries. Even countries that don't have land in the Arctic are sitting on the Arctic Council and things like that. So I know this is a big thing, but can you set the stage for us? Like, who are some of these actors? What's going on?
What we have observed through the analysis of these projects and also social movements in the Arctic region, so the main actors protesting are indigenous peoples and pastoralists as well all around the Arctic. We also observe strong presence of supporting groups such as NGOs. And we also observed when we did the analysis that the actors, they, let's say, connect in this resistance all around the Arctic between them, and they form a social movement as a core element all around the Arctic as well. So this was also surprising finding when we analyzed the data. Also, in this resistance, what we found was that governmental actors, let's say, they are rarely present in questions of sustainability, let's say, of the Arctic region, although they take the decision what is the best for the region as well. We also observed, like in more recent work that was not published, but it's work in progress, that China has a strong presence in the Arctic, let's say, extractive economies. And now I'm focusing my work on the Polar Silk Road as well. That has become very important to see all these investments that also come from outside the region or the countries that claim their territories in the region.
That's really interesting. I mean, usually when I'm thinking about the Arctic, you know, I'm thinking about, okay, the Arctic, it's the countries you mentioned, right? It's Russia, it's Finland, Sweden, the Nordics, the US, that Arctic. But I mean, I guess this is part of why you're characterizing it as a resource frontier, because there's countries that are not Arctic countries that are so involved. And you mentioned China. What's China doing in the Arctic? What kind of commodities are moving on the Arctic Silk Road?
The analysis also showed that there is a huge variety of commodities that are extracted in the Arctic region. So we are not talking only about like oil and gas, which is important, and which brings me back to the previous question, that served as the main activities for the richest countries in the world. They come from the Arctic. For example, Norway's economy is heavily dependent on oil extraction. That comes from the Arctic region. No? So yeah, there is a huge variety of commodities, as I mentioned, extracted. So diamonds, uranium extraction methods, new and old one, including the so-called energy transition methods. We also have copper extraction. We also have water distribution conflicts. Water is not directly extracted, but it's used for all this industrial development. We also have coal extraction, mainly meant for the Indian market more recently. So huge variety of commodities that are extracted from the region.
Wow, that is really amazing. I mean, this is a really big variety. So I guess with this, what do we mean by a Silk Road in this case? Because I mean, like, you know, with the Belt and Road is a little bit in some ways nonsensical because the belt part is over land and then the road part is over the sea. But what's consisting of this? Because I mean, in Finland, there's been some talk in the years of like a Chinese built railway between the far north and south to be able to get resources out. But what types of things and what like infrastructure is going into this?
Huge industrial infrastructure along the Polar Silk Road that we call it. It's an alternative to the Southern Silk Road, let's say. And the consequences and the industrial development and infrastructure are almost the same, let's say. We also, what we observed, in the terms of infrastructure and, let's say, so-called development of the Arctic region, are also nuclear power plants, floating nuclear power plants, as well as icebreakers, huge amount of icebreakers that can bring commodities from the Russian part to China, but also before the Ukrainian invasion also involved from the European Arctic via the Russian to China. So big investments. We have Yamal natural gas project in the Arctic region on indigenous lands that currently supplies Europe with gas, and also a new pipeline, Power of Siberia 2, is in a process of development, which will bring also natural gas to China via Mongolia. So these are huge, enormous project in terms of extraction, but also infrastructure.
That certainly does sound like a lot of infrastructure that needs to be in place to make these activities possible. And I think that it's really interesting too that you mentioned the icebreaker ships, because those icebreaker ships in and of themselves are such floating infrastructure projects, as you will. I know one of the things that I've always found a bit disquieting is sometimes in the media, you see like these huge celebrations of like, oh, icebreaker ships can go through the Arctic. It's like, wait, but is this a good thing? I don't think it's a good thing. It doesn't seem like a good thing to me. So yeah, I think it's really interesting the kind of disconnect that maybe the wider public has about, you know, thinking, oh yeah, it's great, now we can ship stuff through the Arctic Sea. And it's like, wait a second though, but is that actually what we want?
As per people that live and depend on the Arctic lands and also protect, as we see in the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice, this is definitely what is problematic. And I don't know, I cannot talk in the name of the people, but if that's what they want, or we at the global level know and beyond the Arctic. But what I can certainly say is that we can question those decisions. And let's say, are we going to open up the Arctic? Let's say, because now there is this opportunity, because climate is changing and there is ice sea and permafrost loss in the region. So is this opportunity for economic growth? And what are the consequences at the local, regional, no, and also global level? I would definitely say that we have to rethink deeply if this is what we want, or if this is a solution that will, prosper economically, the countries involved, and the well-being of all people involved in management, let's say, and territory of the Arctic region.
Thank you so much for that. I guess like something's popping into my head. Of course, you know, going back to like the Arctic covers so many countries, so many different types of people. How far does this kind of cross-border alliance of resistance or cooperation on resistance go? I mean, is this just like Eurasia, or is it just like North America, or is it like going across the continents?
From the analysis we saw, and we called it transversal resistance, we saw that it goes all around the Arctic region and across the Arctic as well. It also depends, and we didn't go into much more detail, but it also depends on proximity of the let's say, activist or environmental justice organizations. No, so it, maybe it's more connected between Canada and the United States, let's say, and also between, for example, just giving an example here, between Norway, Finland, and also Russian Federation, especially Kola Peninsula and Yamal Peninsula as well. So this is what we observed, let's say. And when reading the literature and from the indigenous activists and scholars themselves, they also, what I read was that the Arctic region actually is one territory, but has been influenced by at least 8 nation states. So depending of the influence, this is the difference that we saw around the Arctic, but it's one territory and it has been a colonized territory historically. And this is what they explain in when we look at the Arctic region as one single unit of analysis. So this is an important point to keep in mind.
Absolutely. It's really interesting too, this idea of the geographical proximity, because I remember the first time, gosh, when was it? It was probably 2014. No, 2013. I went to a conference in Abisko, Sweden that was specifically talking about Arctic issues. And I remember it was the first time in my life that I'd ever seen a map that was actually Arctic centered. And I remember it was like this huge moment of realization that like, oh, it really is actually quite close together when you're looking at it from that perspective. It's not Canada way over here and then you have to, I don't know, fly all the way around the world or however you're getting there. But like when you're looking at it from above with the Arctic actually centered in a map, oh, that really is a region. Yeah, I always remember kind of that moment of shock in that conference of like, oh, I'm like seeing the world in a whole different way now.
Yeah, in the Arctic region, according to your comment, then we can see exactly how a nation state's borders are produced, let's say, and how historically and how people use their territory is very different. This is also why today in the Arctic region is very important to see the migrations and also with all these nation states' borders and new extractive projects, people are not allowed to use their territories as they were using before. This is also an important aspect when we look at the extractive industries in the Arctic region, and not to mention the history of colonization of the Arctic. So this is also an important aspect when activists and local communities and indigenous communities try to approach or try to explain what are the whole different issues that are taking place with all this development of the Arctic. It's not only biophysical transformation. It's everything. It's the history of colonization, which also has to be acknowledged in the studies on the Arctic region.
Absolutely. And that is such a huge thing. And to dig into that a bit, you know, we have touched on this a little bit in a previous episode, I think, with Maya Lassila. But could you dive into this colonization of the Arctic a bit? Because, of course, you know, when we think of the like North American context and the First Nation peoples of the Arctic there, well, yes, of course, the whole continent colonization. But people don't usually think of, say, Eurasia or like the Nordic context when they think of colonization. So yeah, could you dive into that a little bit more? What kind of colonization is going on? Really, these are not just other sorts of European peoples, as is thought of in popular conceptions in like northern Scandinavia?
Yeah, the process of colonization in general and the Arctic region in particular, let's say in the Nordic context and also Russian Federation context. So it's one part, it starts with invasion of the Northern Territory. But also we can see the concept of colonization, that it can also be, doesn't have to be always, let's say, Western. It can be also Eastern and part of imperialism, let's say, and domination. And also, which is very important part of the process of colonization, is that it can occur internally everywhere, including South Europe and also Northern Europe. But in this context, we are looking only on the Arctic region. Another example, it could also be Eastern Europe and within the country, the southern part or the northern part, or even within the same city and the center and the periphery relations, no? So this is more or less to approach the process of colonization and also neglecting all kind of other types of thinking, knowing and being, no? These are also parts of colonization. And another aspect that I would like to highlight is that colonization also goes beyond this physical invasion. And the last aspect of colonization that we also have to keep in mind is that people resist because they exist. So people are putting the colonial movement in the whole history of colonization, which of course go beyond only invasion of the physical territory.
I think those conceptualizations of space are really important. And I know that Marcus and some of his work has done quite extensive work on like looking at some of those different spaces that exist within a single space. It's not just the physical, it's not just the political, it's also like the mental, the feeling space. I said that much, much less articulately than Marcus does. And if anybody is interested to hear Marcus talk about some of those different spaces, we'll make sure to link his podcast down below where he actually said that in an articulate and beautiful manner, which I did not quite manage. You did a better job than I did. What was the most surprising thing that came out of this study? Like, as a researcher, like, what surprised you?
The most surprising, I would say, was when we start to identify the cases, so the amount of cases taking place, which brings me to say that usually mainstream media and academic, let's say, especially related to mainstream economics, Arctic is perceived as empty polar space. There is nothing going on above 60 degrees north. And then when we start to look at it, there is a lot of going on, and there is a resistance or this transversal collective effort to protect and to preserve the Arctic region. So that was surprising from the beginning. So as I said, when I started working on the Russian part for the Environmental Justice Atlas, so it was one case after the another, one after the another. So at the beginning, maybe we had 15 cases, and then at the end of the investigation, it was 53 projects with conflictive outcomes. Another interesting aspect of the study was that when we were looking at the Arctic region in such a different context in terms of level of democracy, we also found that if in a country of high level of democracy, more violent outcomes towards activists are likely to occur, especially when the country depends on the commodity extracted at one particular, let's say, case, no? So for example, oil in Norway. So this is what we were surprised of seeing. So this would be the second important or interesting aspect that we found within the study.
That's fascinating. And like you speaking to something that was like kind of starting to pop in my head. I find this really interesting as well, like my original background being in like security, international relations. And this actually reminds me of, was it limited war theory, where if a war happens closer to home for a country, they're more likely to go all out and be drafting everyone and, you know, fight extra hard. Whereas if it's further away, then countries won't necessarily put as much into it. So it's very interesting to me. Yeah, like this sort of vital natural resource to the economy as it's perceived by a country, even if it has this high level of democracy or is internationally thought of as being much more, perhaps saying touchy-feely isn't the most scientific term, but it's really interesting. And so I guess coming off of this, what kind of modes of resistance are we seeing? Are they violent modes of resistance that then, like, you know, these countries are being violent in response, which I'm not saying that's right, but, or are they being violent against nonviolent resistance?
Definitely not a violent mode of protesting. It's other way around. So peaceful democratic demonstrations have resulted from the country's authorities violent towards people protesting. So, and in the Arctic region, what we observed is that forms of mobilization are often media-based activism. So it was also interesting, if we go back to the previous question part, to see and more or less, let's say, street protests in comparison in other maybe geographical regions or other studies that we have been looking at. So it's also the opportunity, let's say, people have to go and protest on the street. But the important thing is to keep in mind that there are many nonviolent forms of resistance taking place in the Arctic region, and that was also supported with the empirical data.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, we've been having such a great conversation, but we know like the afternoon's getting on and you have a lot of things you need to be getting on to. And we're so grateful for your time today. But before we wrap up, we always like to ask something of our guests.
Wait, what are you talking about? What time is it?
It could be...
No.
Question time?
It is question time.
Best time of the day.
Thank you so much. We always like to ask our guests the question. It's sort of a call to action for our listeners. You know, they're listening to this. They are fascinated. They've been learning things, but they want to be able to do something. What is something you could recommend for our listeners that they can do? It could be something in their daily lives, could be thinking about something, could be reading something, just something that they can take out into their lives from this conversation.
I would definitely suggest having a look at the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice to see the whole overview of all these documented cases and people protesting or caring about what's going on in environmental and social terms around all these highly negative consequences of the extractive and industrial development around the world. And also, I would suggest being aware of or questioning what are the solutions now that we have been said, and feel free to question all these new solutions that some and more often powerful actors are bringing to us. So what are the solutions? And also to critically analyze what are the false solutions, although they are might be more often than not labeled as sustainable, labeled as green, and ecologically, let's say, friendly and socially also sustainable, because from the political ecology point of view, everything in ecology is political. So we should not forget about that message from the political ecology point of view.
What a great answer to the question. So you heard it here first, people. Watch out for the greenwashing. Stay critical. Stay critical.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there are not so direct solutions, but certainly we should question the false solutions. And I also think it's a collective work between civil society, academics, activists. And maybe we should sit together and open the dialogue towards real transformations and real, let's say, alternatives that we are all looking forward to.
Absolutely. And thank you so much. I mean, we'd love to have you back on sometime because we're just getting into like some of these really great ideas and there's a lot more we can dig into here. So yeah, hopefully we'll bring you back on sometime in the future and we can continue this great conversation. But Ksenia, thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with us and sharing with our listeners.
Thank you so much. We really appreciated this conversation, and you definitely have given us a lot of really good food for thought.
Thank you both for the invitation, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
A huge thank you again to Ksenia Hanacek for coming on and sharing her insights into extractivism in the Arctic. Please join us next month when we're going to be welcoming back Alexander Dunlap to talk about the orthodoxy of green extractivism. Also, this is the third anniversary of the Exalt podcast, so released at the same time as this episode, if you want some more Exalt, we have a special bonus episode looking at extractivism in the Lord of the Rings universe featuring a friend of the show who's been on very recently. From the rainy days and bright leaves of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.